thanks very much for joining me again. I'm James Curran. I'm Professor of Modern History here at Sydney University and also the International Editor at the Australian Financial Review, where I write regularly about Australia in world affairs. Now, before we start today, I just want to clear up a small problem. What lingers around the Australian foreign policy debate, I think with a very bad smell, is this view that Australia before World War II didn't have a foreign policy of her own. The question is here, what do we mean by policy? I think a policy is a government's considered response to an issue, where it identifies the problem, reaches a decision as to what should be done, and then it attempts to achieve the desired outcome. Now, while it's agreed that Australia during this era, right, this is the first 40 or so years of the Commonwealth, while it's agreed that Australia had a defence policy, it's often said that it didn't have a foreign policy, only attitudes towards international affairs. Those who take this position do so on the grounds that Australia didn't have an external affairs department until 1936, remembering that it was called External Affairs until it was renamed the Department of Foreign Affairs in the 1970s. They also say that Australia didn't have independent diplomatic representation abroad until 1940, that they relied on the British Foreign Service to protect their nationals and their interests in foreign countries. Therefore, so this view goes, Australia did not and could not have a foreign policy of its own. But this is surely too technical and narrow a position. We need to wrench ourselves out of the araldite of thinking that nothing happened before 1942 in terms of Australian foreign policy. If one looks at Australian government behaviour in this period, it meets the essentials of the policy definition. Governments do not have to have professional bureaucratic advice in order to have a policy. It might be desirable, but it is not necessary, as many government policies in many countries exemplify. For most of this period, Australia in formal constitutional terms was a colony or dominion, a subordinate part of the British Empire. In formal terms, the British Empire had one foreign policy, which was made in Whitehall, all those buildings made of the white stone. But in practice, Australian governments, like all those of the other self-governing parts of the empire, were autonomous and acted as they saw fit to protect the people, or to put it in another way, their political community, that they represented and to whom they were responsible. Though the British government, in granting self-government first to the colonies and then to the Commonwealth, had reserved the right through the governors and governors-general to advise the monarch not to assent to Australian Acts of Parliament, nevertheless this power was very rarely used in the colonial era and no British government attempted to exercise it in the Commonwealth era. Despite disliking some major pieces of legislation of the Commonwealth Parliament, such as the 1901 Immigration Restriction Act, the British government recognised that they could not enforce their will, and that any attempt to do so would be resisted and result in the breakup of the empire. Billy Hughes, in the debate over the Immigration Act, specifically warned that Australia would follow the path of the American colonies if the British tried to block the clearly expressed will of the Australian people. So, my point is this, that from the end of the 19th century, as we'll see, Australian governments did identify foreign problems threatening the country's security, especially problems emanating from Asia. They analysed the problems and reached conclusions which they attempted to act upon. Primarily, they sought to achieve their objectives through influencing their great power protector, namely Britain. But they also, on occasion, when Britain was unsympathetic or seemed obtuse, approached directly foreign governments such as America, Japan, and France. Being a small power, they generally had little leverage and so frequently had to accept defeat. But this fact made their efforts no less what could be called policies. So let me turn, after that introduction, to Australia's foreign and defence policy in this era of mass nationalism. And I want to look at three particular things here. I want to look at nationalism and the community of interest. Secondly, I want to explore with you the tensions over Britishness that arose for Australia from geopolitics. In other words, what I'm saying, the tensions which arose from, on the one hand, belonging to an empire whose centre, of course, was in Europe, and on the other, Australia, of course, being located in the Asia-Pacific region. And lastly, I'll look at the crisis deriving from this tension created at the time of the Japanese military threat to the survival of Australia in the Second World War. Now, to understand Australia's foreign defence policy in this era, we have to consider how nationalism is connected to national security. Nationalism offers people two linked but very distinct needs. As we saw in the last episode, through cultural nationalism, It offers them social identity and psychological security, and it does that through its myths. But through political nationalism, it offers people's physical and material security, including protection from external enemies. And in nearly all Western countries at this time, these two promises of nationalism coincided completely. Australia is unique in that in its case, the community of culture and the community of interest were frequently, and in some cases, fundamentally at odds. Now let me unpack that a bit more, because in all other Western countries, except perhaps New Zealand, it's the romance of the cultural myth which tended to define what nationalism meant. And certainly, this is what Benedict Anderson and Ernest Gellner are discussing in their work and treating as the essence of nationalism. This was possible because in nearly all cases, political nationalism, if you like, was assumed, and that assumption was justified. In Europe, culture determined the boundaries of the states. National self-determination was the principle which settled the legitimacy of government. So in addition to common cultural myths, people shared common political interests. That is, the defence of one was equally the defence of each. So, what we're calling the political community of interest was at one with the mythological community of culture. Look, for a contemporary example of this, think no further than George W. Bush's second inaugural address, in which he told the American people, he said,
"America's deepest beliefs and its most vital interests are now one."
A perfect encapsulation of how the Americans see their political community at one with their cultural one. Now, the point is, in Australia, this was not the case. Indeed, the very novelty of Australia's response to mass nationalism is very interesting. To put it simply, the great physical distance which separated Australia from Britain created fundamental conflicts of interest which produced a tension between their cultural loyalty and their political interests, and it was never resolved. From the end of the 19th century, though Australia was fervently British in its culture, it had in many respects a different view from the British of world politics, and especially the threats facing the empire. And all of its parliaments passed legislation which Westminster found embarrassing or objectionable. And the Commonwealth adopted foreign and defence policies to meet the needs, as it saw them, of Australia's interests and security. And it did it in defiance of the British government and all the great British departments of state, the Committee for Imperial Defence, the Foreign Office, the Commonwealth Office, the Admiralty, the War Office. What I'm saying is that there is no question that from the establishment of the Commonwealth, Australia in this sense was a political nation. Now, yes, I fully concede the language of this problem is confusing, because Australian leaders could, and they did, use the term nation to mean both belonging to and being part of a worldwide British race, and at the same time, belonging to and being part of an autonomous Australian nation state. To show, however, the power of cultural nationalism, we must bear in mind that Australian governments, in acting independently, did not seek this independence. They believed that the empire should protect equally the interests of all the scattered British communities around the globe. But when they saw that the British government in London had no sympathy with their Asian concerns and would sacrifice Australian interests in order to strengthen its position in Europe, well, the Australians had a sense of being betrayed. Even so, this did not make them feel any less British. Now, there was a lot of dirty laundry and a lot of strong words that were exchanged between Australian and British leaders. Do you think they aired that dirty laundry in public? Not on your Nelly. And the key point is that these kinds of tensions didn't lead to a desire to separate. There was no demand for a republic that had to wait until the 1990s. Rather, after each crisis in the relationship, they told themselves, indeed how they deluded themselves, that next time the British would do the right thing, that if only they were consulted more, if only they went to more conferences, that this would make London understand their responsibilities and enable finally the British peoples to face the world as one. Now, many scholars and historians who are in some ways, I think, seduced by nationalism's own view of history, I talked about in the last episode, when they recognised Australia's differences with Britain, and on occasion Australia's defiance of Britain, have deduced from this that Australian history from the end of the 19th century was one of thwarted nationalism. And this, of course, is the argument that was really put forward by the historian Neville Meaney in a number of articles and books. Think, if you like, of Manning Clark's concept of Australian history being between the old dead tree of British Philistinism and the young tree green of Australian nationalism. There's your classic kind of construct. Now, in this reading, Australians are frustrated in achieving their objective by the manipulations of the British government or the treachery of an Anglo-Australian ruling class or by the need to have the protection of the British Navy. Now, when you set aside nationalism's own assumptions, where is the evidence for this view of Australian history? Now, were Labor Prime Ministers John Curtin and Ben Chifley puppets in the hands of these influences in the 1940s? Is that what we're really saying? And if so, in this era, who were the people supposedly struggling against it to achieve a distinctively Australian, British-free nationalism? So, have a think about that. Secondly, we're moving now on to Australia's consciousness of Asia. Let's look a little bit more at these tensions between Australia and Britain over geopolitics. From the late 19th century, the Australian colonies began to see threats emanating from their Asia-Pacific environment. These appeared first in the guise of European imperialism. In the last decades of the century, the great European powers were engaged in a competition for colonies, which would give them prestige, resources, and naval bases. Germany had its eye on East New Guinea and its associated islands. France had their peepers on the New Hebrides. The Australians feared that if Britain became involved in a war in Europe, these islands might be used as bases from which to attack their commerce, cities, and coasts. Thus, Queensland, alarmed in early 1883 by a rumour that the Germans were intent on annexing eastern New Guinea, sent a force to raise the British flag and claim the territory for the Empire. Now, this was a bit inconvenient for the British government, which was attempting to reconcile Germany to its taking control of the Suez Canal, and consequently, London disavowed Queensland's action. Well, you can imagine how that went down back in Brisbane and elsewhere around the colonies. The colonists took umbrage at this indifference to their concerns, and at a conference of premiers they declared, taking a leaf out of the American diplomatic notebook, that further acquisition of dominions in the South Pacific by any foreign power would be highly detrimental to their safety and well-being. This so-called Australasian Munro Doctrine for the South Pacific was the first signs of a foreign policy, and it was accompanied by the first attempt at a federal union, that is, the first attempts at the Federation of the Colonies. Now, almost simultaneously, as I discussed previously, the colonies became almost hysterically anxious about Asian immigration. The threat from the north again brought the colonies together and caused them to agree on a common response. Firstly, in effect, excluding all Chinese and then all peoples of Asian, African, or Pacific Island descent. These fears that the teeming millions of Asia might descend upon the continent and overwhelm the 2 million whites scattered thinly along its length and breadth, like the fears of European powers establishing themselves in the region, these all gave Australians a sense of belonging to a community of interest. And it's against that background that Australian Federation was finally achieved. Now, at this very time, some British political leaders were attempting to persuade all the self-governing colonies in the Empire to join in some form of imperial federation. At the 1897 Colonial Conference, when all the premiers of the colonies met in London, the Colonial Secretary, Joseph Chamberlain, proposed that they should all unite in an imperial council which would determine the Empire's defence and foreign policy. But the Australian premiers poured cold water all over this plan. They feared that London would dominate the council and that this would be at the expense of their own interests. As a result of recent experience with the British over matters of policy touching the Pacific, they'd come to realise that Britain had different interests and other priorities. So they were apprehensive. They were apprehensive because they felt that if they took part in such an imperial council, Britain might be able to negate Australian policies which were embarrassing to it, like the White Australia policy, or that they could use Australian resources for British purposes and so put Australian security at risk. In other words, despite their Britishness, they didn't feel necessarily that Australian and British interests were one. In Australia, on the other hand, the colonies, because of their experiences in the preceding decades, had come to see that they did share a common interest in protecting themselves against a dangerous Asia and Pacific region. And of course, that was a central motive in compelling them to set aside their differences in one indissoluble federal union, Federation, in 1901. Now, under that federal constitution, which came into effect in 1901, the Commonwealth Parliament was given power over defence, immigration, trade, the Pacific Islands, and external affairs. Now, what the constitution makers intended by external affairs is not clear, but it can be said that they'd had some troubling experiences with the British on foreign policy, which may have influenced its inclusion amongst the Commonwealth's power. Certainly was a novel power for the constitution of a self-governing colony. Canada, for example, had not thought it appropriate to claim such a power when it had federated some years before. The Commonwealth Government's first great international problem arose out of Japan's victory over Russia in the Russo-Japanese War of 1905. The Australian government, a great majority of the parliamentarians and the daily press had initially sympathised with Japan, Britain's ally in the Far East. Japan, of course, was seen to be useful in curbing Russian ambitions. Its efforts in resisting Russia's push into Manchuria would maintain a balance of power in Northeast Asia. But after Japan achieved an overwhelming victory at the Naval Battle of Tsushima Straits, making it the first Asian to defeat one of the great European powers, Australian attitudes underwent a transformation. Australians now feared not only a migratory, but also a military invasion from Asia. As Alfred Deakin saw it, Japan's victory had made it the unchallenged master of the Western Pacific. At the same time, Britain was withdrawing its capital ships from the Pacific to help maintain its margin of superiority over the German Navy in the North Sea. Deakin argued that Australia was in grave danger, and here was the two-ocean dilemma. Japan resented greatly the humiliation of the wide Australia policy, and might well use its power to try to force change, or even, should war break out in Europe, to invade Australia. This was the fear. Deakin's analysis came to be shared by all parties and all governments. They distrusted the Anglo-Japanese alliance. Indeed, the fear of Japan swept through the country. It permeated all forms of popular culture. It inspired poetry, like Henry Lawson's Australia's Peril, C.J. Dennis's Australase, cartoons by Norman Lindsay and Livingston Hopkins, novels such as C.H. Kermesse's The Australian Crisis, plays such as Randolph Bedford's White Australia, and even a film by Raymond Longford, Australia Calls. There was a whole genre of invasion scare novels coming out at the time. Now, when the British authorities dismissed these Australian fears and maintained that Australia was the safest part of the empire, the Commonwealth replied that from their perspective, Australia was the most vulnerable part. The Australian leaders recognised that as a result of the tensions in Europe, it couldn't expect any help from the British Navy. And in this decade prior to the First World War, the Australian governments embarked on an ambitious defence programme aimed solely at safeguarding Australia against a Japanese invasion. And again, this is in defiance of the British Committee for Imperial Defence, the Admiralty and the War Office. So from 1909, Australia, against British tradition, introduced compulsory military training in peacetime, aimed at creating an army of over 100,000. And this army was exclusively for the defence of Australia. The Defence Act of 1903 laid down the foundation principles for the army. It allowed for conscription for the defence of Australian territories, but only permitted volunteers to be raised for overseas expeditions or imperial contingents. And the government also acquired a modest naval fleet. Realising the inadequacy of Australia's resources in dealing with a great power like Japan, Prime Minister Deakin turned to America and in 1908 sent a direct request to President Teddy Roosevelt, inviting him to allow the American Great White Fleet to visit Sydney and Melbourne as part of its world tour. Deakin explained in a letter to an English friend that his action was inspired by
distrust of the yellow race in the North Pacific, code for Japan, and that he looked to the US to join an entente cordiale spreading among all white men who realised the yellow peril to Caucasian values.
Carried away by the fleet's very successful visit to Australia, over a quarter of the population turned out to greet the Americans, Deakin, in the following year, proposed to the British government what he called
an agreement for the extension of the American Monroe Doctrine to all the countries around the Pacific Ocean, supported by the guarantees of the BE, Holland, France, and China.
Both Britain's enemy Germany and Australia's enemy Japan were to be excluded. Despite his language about the yellow peril, Deakin was happy to have China, since it also feared Japan, as a partner in this would-be alliance. While his idea went nowhere, it was, however, a serious attempt to deal with what the Australian government believed was a serious danger to its national security. From 1912 to 1914, Britain was under increasing pressure from German naval building, and so it arbitrarily tore up an agreement reached in 1909 to help Australia, Canada, and New Zealand establish a cooperative Pacific fleet. Indeed, the first Lord of the Admiralty, young Winston Churchill no less, told the Australians that keeping their fleet in the Pacific was a waste of imperial resources. It should be sent to the North Sea, said Churchill, where it could serve some useful purpose. Australian government was infuriated by Churchill's behaviour, not for the first time, not for the last time, and once more informed the British of their view of the dangers facing the Empire, namely that the Anglo-Japanese alliance could not be relied upon. Now this relatively hot exchange between Melbourne and London was brought at least temporarily to an end by the outbreak of World War I. As we've seen, Australia rallied enthusiastically to the British cause. This quarrel over Japan and the Pacific in no way undermined Australia's identification with the Empire. Both culture and interest made them see that they should contribute to the British war effort. They were British. They owed it to their kith and kin. Moreover, they knew that if Germany should force Britain and its allies to their knees, then Australia would be at the mercy of the Germans, or even more likely, the Japanese. But Australians responded offering help with another eye glancing over their shoulder at Japan. Shortly after the outbreak of the war, Labor Prime Minister Andrew Fisher promised to aid the mother country, as we know, everyone remembers this, to the last man and the last shilling. Now that is his cultural loyalty speech. But he also said this, that
his idea of patriotism was to first provide for our defence, and then if there was anything to spare, offer it as a tribute to the mother country.
Now that one is not often found in the history books. But that's the policy that Australia had developed in the aftermath of the Russo-Japanese War. Though Japan was an ally in that war, it was an uncertain ally, and Australia did not abandon its fear of Japan. It was alarmed that Japan had been able to seize German islands in the North Pacific, which brought Japan's borders to the equator. The University of Sydney was asked by the Department of Defence to appoint a professor of Japanese studies. The university acted as a cover for the Department of Defence. It chose the candidate, it paid their salary. And in return, that candidate had to spend 3 days a week in Canberra at the Royal Military College, educating Australia's future officers in the history and language of the future enemy. The candidate was also to help translate for the government intercepted Japanese messages. And at the end of the war, the government sent him on a covert mission to try to discover what Japan's post-war policy was likely to be. The chief of Australia's military intelligence, justifying the exercise, told the Australian Prime Minister at the time that British Foreign Office advice could not be relied upon, because he said the British saw problems of the Pacific from a different perspective. At the end of the First World War, Australia's PM, the pugnacious Billy Hughes, whose British race credentials could never be questioned, quarrelled publicly with the British Prime Minister David Lloyd George. He called the Imperial War Cabinet a farce and a sham. At the Paris Peace Conference at Versailles in 1919, Hughes pursued what he regarded as a realist policy. President Woodrow Wilson's liberal internationalist 14-point peace plan left Billy Hughes cold. He placed no trust in the League of Nations. Writing to Lloyd George about the future of the German islands in the Pacific, he said, quote,
"Australia profoundly distrusts Japan."
And to this end, he wanted nothing less than to annex those islands. Likewise, he was absolute in standing against every Japanese attempt, no matter how modest, no matter how indirect in language, to insert a racial equality principle in the League Charter or Covenant. In both these efforts, he had to fight the British. In the latter, he had ultimately forced them to support his view. Now, what was the outcome of the war experience for Australia? Did more conflicts over interests, more British betrayals, lead to a conclusion that Australia should separate from the Empire, or at the very least, no longer attempt to achieve a common position in facing up to the world? The answer is no. In the years between World War I and World War II, The imperial conferences which brought together the prime ministers of the dominions were no longer interested in achieving common policies. The Irish Free State, Canada, and South Africa led the way in changing the empire into a commonwealth, symbol of this autonomy and equality. They insisted on having the right to negotiate and sign treaties on their own behalf, and to appoint diplomats to foreign powers, and generally to act as they saw fit on every issue. Now, these changes were embodied in 1926 in the Balfour Declaration and in 1931 in the Statute of Westminster. Now, what was Australia's attitude to those developments? Well, it was a grudging acquiescence. Prime Minister Stanley Melbourne Bruce, before he set off for that 1926 Imperial Conference where the Balfour Declaration was made, sensed what was in front of him. He said that he deplored the possible disintegration of the wider British nation, which he feared the other dominions would bring about. Australians instead wanted better exchanges of information and more frequent consultation. They hoped that could still make the system work. By the early 1930s, a new international crisis was brewing, which boded ill for Australia. In Europe, the rise of the Nazi Party to power in Germany threatened the 1919 peace settlement, and in the Pacific, Japan had set out on an imperial course in Manchuria and then China proper. Step by step, Japan's actions had widened a breach with Britain and the US, and as a result, it was drawn into an alliance with Germany. It seemed that the British Empire might have to fight a war on two fronts. For Australia, it seemed like a replay of the years before the First World War. This time, the threat from Japan looked much more menacing. Now, the Australian response had a number of dimensions. In 1934, John Latham, then External Affairs Minister, as the Foreign Affairs Minister was then called, Latham visited Tokyo. And it was a mission which arose out of a sense that Britain, by criticising Japan's aggression in Manchuria, had created a tension between the British Empire and Japan, and it was going to be Australia that would suffer the consequences. So Latham's mission was to do two things: to express understanding for Japan's action in Manchuria, and simultaneously to warn Japan against coming south. And Latham, without any good grounds for saying it, told the Japanese foreign minister that if Japan was so foolish, it would have to contend not only with the British Navy, but even possibly America. He even advised the Japanese foreign minister that if Japan
be so foolhardy as to land an army in Australia, she would have in her hands a very lively nest of hornets.
On his return, Latham told the Australian cabinet that Australia should be quite content that Japan remained preoccupied in Northeast Asia, and that should it become involved in a confrontation with the Soviet Union, then there was no good reason why anyone should interfere. Australia should encourage America and Britain to recognise Japan's position in Manchuria and thereby perhaps reach an accommodation with Japan and so end the tensions which might have dire results for Australia. The Prime Minister at the time, Joe Lyons, when he visited Washington and London, pressed that policy forward. But for a variety of reasons, it fell on barren ground. Perceiving that it would be very difficult for Britain to send a fleet to the Pacific to deter Japan if war broke out in Europe, Australia once again turned to America. Following to some degree Deakin's earlier example, the Australians proposed a Pacific Pact, centred on the US, and as a result of which, all parties would agree to respect the existing territorial arrangements in the Pacific. Now, this had the advantage of both at least diplomatically involving the United States more directly in Pacific affairs, while at the same time giving tacit recognition to Japan's occupation of Manchuria. But again, the initiative failed to gain support. Australia had no choice but to rely on its own defences and good luck. During the 1930s, there was a fierce debate over defence policy. The government of Prime Minister Joseph Lyons remained committed to its belief in empire. It held officially to the line that the British Navy could be relied upon to hold the great naval base being built at Singapore. So at first, it gave the greater share of its defence appropriations to the Australian Navy. The plan was that the Australian fleet would join with the British fleet, which would be sent to Singapore in a time of crisis. But by 1937, this assumption was being increasingly questioned. Among those airing their disquiet were John Curtin, the leader of the Labour opposition, General Laverack, chief of the General Staff, and intellectuals concerned with Australian foreign policy. For them, it was obvious that once Britain was at war with Germany, it wouldn't be able to risk sending a major fleet to Singapore. Thus, to meet a possible assault from Japan, taking advantage of a European war, Australia should direct the greater part of its defence spending to the Army and the Air Force. And it is noticeable that by 1937, the Lyons government was beginning to direct a greater proportion of its increased defence spending to the Army and the Air Force, while still holding publicly to the line that a British fleet would be available, as the British government had promised. By early 1939, the Australian government was so concerned about Australia's position in the Pacific that they finally decided to appoint their own diplomatic representatives to the major countries in the Pacific, the United States, Japan, and China. This was Prime Minister Bob Menzies in his first period as Prime Minister. This was his first act in office. And this from the man who had deplored all the 1920s and 1930s changes to the British Commonwealth, which he believed had weakened the Empire's unity. Explaining himself, he declared that,
"In the Pacific, we have primary responsibilities and primary risks. What Great Britain calls the Far East is to us the near North."
In other words, it was Australia's interests which were dictated by its geopolitics that had forced Menzies' reluctant hand. When the war came, Menzies, like Andrew Fisher before him, accepted that since Britain was at war, Australia too was automatically at war. However, when the British appealed for him to send the second AIF immediately to Europe, he refused. He would raise a force, but it would not depart until he was satisfied that its departure would not endanger Australia. Until he was convinced that Japan would remain neutral, the Australian force would remain in Australia. And he sent a member of his cabinet to London to consult with British authorities about their optimistic expectations about Japanese behaviour. It was not until 3 months after the declaration of war that Menzies agreed that the first contingent of the second AIF should be allowed to sail. Now, the entry of the Japanese into the war opened a new chapter in Australia's defence and foreign policy. Australia's reliance on British promises was shown to be a mistake. Britain could not send a fleet. The two capital ships that Churchill sent had no air cover and were quickly sunk by Japanese Zeros. Singapore fell. Australia's 8th Division was captured. Japan then swept swiftly southward through Dutch East Indies and on into New Guinea, and so brought the war to Australia's doorstep. These are the horror years of 1941 and early 1942. Curtin, in this situation, now Prime Minister, demanded that the British allow 2 of 3 divisions in North Africa to be sent home. Reluctantly, Churchill agreed. But they were only halfway across the Indian Ocean when the British Prime Minister, trying to hold the line in Burma, had the transports diverted to Colombo in readiness to be sent to join the retreating British forces in Burma, as it was then called. Curtin was adamant that they should not be left there and that they should return to help with the defence of Australia. And against appeals from the British Prime Minister and the American President, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Curtin remained firm, and he had his way. It was Curtin's view that Australia's security was the fundamental policy for an Australian government. He would never agree to a policy that would risk Australia being conquered in order that Britain might survive and perhaps at some later time come to Australia's rescue. He was, he said,
"determined that Australia should not go."
All Australian forces, no matter how inadequate they might still prove in warding off a superior foe, nevertheless had as their first duty the defence of their political community, Australia. So, did this new crisis in Anglo-Australian relations, what some historians have called the Great Betrayal, did that bring about a rethinking of Australia's place in the world? Did that bring about a rethinking of its relationship to what Australians still called the Empire? Did it bring about a decision to cut the painter and give up the Britishness ideal of a common defence and foreign policy in facing the world? Well, yet again, I'm sorry to say, the answer is no. In 1944, Curtin went to London to a British Commonwealth Prime Minister's Conference and spoke glowingly of Australia as a bastion of the British-speaking race. And his answer to the failure of the Between the Wars policy to work was to improve the machinery for cooperation, to seek a more integrated process for policy making. Well, the British had seen this all before, and so were the other dominions. And so, faced by the South African and Canadian opposition and British indifference, he had no choice but to concede defeat. In fact, on the very day that he presented these ideas for an Empire Council, Churchill did not even show up, and nor did the South African Prime Minister, Smuts. They were offered a briefing with Montgomery about the D-Day landings that were coming up in June of 1944. So, to finish, in considering then how Australia as a nation state worked, it's clear that from its foundations, that governments would have preferred, in accordance with the imperatives of their cultural loyalty, their community of culture, they would have preferred to have a common foreign and defence policy with Britain and the rest of the empire, and so by that means find security in the embrace of a great and powerful protector. But what I've tried to show is that from the beginning, policymakers, despite their best hopes, were forced to recognise that Britain, in crucial respects, that is, those determined by geopolitics, and in crucial times, that's those that threatened war, they had a very different outlook on the world and a different set of strategic interests and priorities. And that as a result, the leaders of the country in Australia put first their responsibility to Australia's community of interests. So successive governments, despite themselves, as Alfred Deakin once put it, developed independent foreign and defence policies which aimed to protect the national interest. Now, this problem has been a continuing one in the history of Australian foreign and defence policy. And in contemporary times, it causes problems for Australian leaders when they feel they have to choose between America, their new great power ally, and their Asian neighbours. No crisis, arguably, although we are in a period where this question of a choice has been absolutely dominant in the discussions over Australia's place in the world, no crisis comparable to World War II has made the choice quite as sharp as that which the Curtin Labor government had to face. But it is still there, and it does require delicate handling. But in looking at how Australia in this era of mass nationalism faced up to the world, it's clear that while it desired that its foreign and defence policy should be one with Britain and the rest of the empire, so that it accorded with its community of culture and its sense of Britishness, nevertheless, when that course conflicted with the imperatives of its community of interest and the political nationalism of the state, it was nearly always the latter that prevailed. Interests triumphed over culture. In the next few episodes, I'm going to be looking at Australia's response to the Cold War, to a world divided by ideology, divided between East and West, between communist and liberal visions of utopian internationalism. I would also like to acknowledge the Indigenous peoples for over 60,000 years who lived on, loved and dreamt about the lands on which I am speaking today, and I pay my respects to their present and future successors who continue to embody their affection for Australia and their enthusiasm for its well-being. This series is produced by Peter Adams for the School of Humanities at the University of Sydney.